thrilled to meet you, Michael and Tanya, and it's nice that the record's not that, it's still pretty young in its release, but the story for me, as so many in Nashville, starts knowing you exactly a year ago at the Americana Conference. And there's a lot to fill in before, but let me ask you to reflect on the year since, because from the observational, those of us who kind of heard like the buzz going around about that walk-on appearance, that got the name in our minds, and many of us as fans and me as a journalist, and then we've watched the year devolve, the anticipation of this record, and we know you all are out there working like crazy since then. What was that like for you, and what did in fact change about your routine and your seriousness of purpose and your sense that this was a real deal?
It has been one incredible journey. I mean, since last September, and Michael and I reflect on it even now, that we were just walking on at, you know, Americana Fest and singing in between the drive-by truckers and the Lumineers, and now this year we'll be closing out that set that we just came on to perform in for Americana Fest. So it has been an amazing ride. So much has changed for us. We're never home, unlike before.
Last year, we were invited by Americana Fest. We were actually going to come with Buddy Miller and just do one song. And Buddy got sick and suggested that we go ahead and take his place. And Americana was so gracious and grateful. And the thing that has changed is now this year, they asked us to come and put us in a slot that is favorable and that sort of thing. And you know, just to see that kind of reaction, it just touched our hearts. And to see people really, really taking and gravitating to not just the music, but the message of love that we carry in our veins. And we're just so honored and so excited to be a part of this year's Americana Fest as well.
Well, how did you know Buddy at the time? Clearly, the relationship had already begun.
Yes, we met Buddy actually through another legend, Mr. Don Was. And we had done a concert for Don in Detroit called the Concert of Colors. And after Don heard us, Don then thought it was necessary for Buddy to become familiar with our band. And once Buddy became familiar, Buddy thought it was necessary for Emmylou Harris to become familiar and Sam Bush to become familiar. And it just snowballed on from there. So,
well, fill me in a bit about the bio makes clear that you are each pursuing solo work. And Michael, under pretty unusual circumstances, you were readjusting to life at home after the war. You'd been a singer, but when you all met and came together, falling in love is one great easy thing to do. Hopefully it's easy. But then to decide that there's a duo there and that to professionalize that duo and decide what that duo is going to sound like and what the repertoire is going to be, that's where I really have a big, vague kind of sense. What happened?
You know, we just started, a friend of ours, heard us sing together. One time my brother couldn't make a studio session. Michael was writing for a project that I was working on with him. And so Michael came in and did the scratch vocals on this particular song. And my friend heard us singing together and she said, "Do you guys hear that?" And we were like, "No, we don't." And by that time we were married for about, I would say 3 years, two and a half, 3 years. And we still weren't singing together as a duo. So Michael started writing songs, and we started having six-hour vocal rehearsals in Maryland. Yeah, that's right, 6 hours. And we would just go to sometimes 8 hours, and we would go to coffee shops in Maryland to work out the kinks. And we kind of just, you know, just worked it out, let our love lead us to different sounds, and we both, you know, enjoy different styles of music. And we just started studying different artists, you know, like the Civil Wars and, of course, the people we grew up listening to, like Mahalia Jackson and James Cleveland and Aretha Franklin and Ray Charles and Johnny Cash and June Carter, all the different artists who we enjoyed. And somehow Michael came up with this sound. And we just put everything into what we love, the sounds that we love.
I read something that described you all almost having different phases where you felt like you were in one kind of channel and then move on to another as you explored what we arrive at here.
Yeah.
That can lead to some, I mean, everybody who's getting started as professionals, they have rough gigs. They have gigs that were mismatched, right? So I was like, I wonder what kind of roads that led you guys down and where you found yourself that led you to go, well, how did we wind up here? Does that bring anything to mind for either of y'all?
Oh, yeah, it definitely does. I remember doing a three-hour set one time. We had to do a club, a bar, actually, and after it was over, we're like, well, we know that this isn't the kind of gigs we need to take because we're a different kind of, at that time, a duo. So we had to change that up and think about what kind of venues we could play, mm-hmm. you know?
Did the Americana and Roots scene, how did that look to you from where you all kind of got started and came up in music? It's a thing that exists in Nashville, and we who've been kind of going to this conference for all these years, we sort of almost lose track of when we did not know that, right? So what did the Roots world, where country meets gospel meets folk, look like to y'all? And when you arrived at the Americana Music Association, did that make total sense?
You know, to be honest with you, I'll tell you the truth. It looked like growing up, when you come from out of the church or with the rich music history that Tanya and I both have, you just go, wow, I mean, I didn't know that's what it was called. You know, I mean, we both grew up on, like we said, Mahalia Jackson, Aretha Franklin, Otis Redding, Big Mama Thornton. Mm-hmm. And then you go about listening to some of those other unmentionables that you don't really hear too much about, you know, those Thomas Whitfields and different Roots players played on those guitars out in their backyards and Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf. You know, it just doesn't look like anything that you haven't seen before. It just looks like family. And then you go to Americana Fest and you see, you know, that it's not true. You start seeing that the genre ain't dead. Mm-hmm. You start seeing that music ain't dead and that people still are playing, you know, guitars with glass fingering and, you know, and you still hear like that kind of gospel, Little Richard piano and songs with Low Cut Connie, you know, and then after you're marveling at how it hasn't gone away, then tears fill up in your eyes. Mm. Because you start feeling the pride and the joy and the power of what people that look like you gone through to make that music. And then you feel the honor.
Did you all know the McCrary sisters before you found your way to Buddy Miller and his deep relationship with them? I was curious if just as one act that we've taken a lot of love from in this city.
You know, no. Uh-huh. Not directly. We didn't know them.
Yeah.
Knew of them. And especially Regina.
Yeah.
And then we got to know them. And then when you know them, you start seeing who they really are behind the music. And you start seeing that they live the songs they sing about. And you want to be around them. You want to eat with them. You want to eat the foods that they can cook. Like that Regina really can throw down, you know. And then you get a chance to sing with these legends on boats like Kayamo and get nicknamed by them. They called me the other McCrary brother when I sang with them. And we even had the opportunity to take Regina's granddaughter out on the road with us and use her as our nanny, give her some work and stuff. And yeah. I mean, it's just a wonderful family atmosphere in this genre, and we love it.
Was there a time when you all ever thought you were going to do a gospel-focused thing, or was secular music always foremost in your mind, or at least sort of a mix, but I mean secular forward music?
I'll be honest, I never thought I would do anything other than gospel. Mm. My background kind of feels similar to like the great Ray Charles, where, I mean, again, you grew up in church and you just love hearing this church music, and then you grow up and you realize that you have more to sing about. And then you fall in love with someone as beautiful and perfect as Tanya, and then you realize you got a hell of a lot more to sing about. Mm-hmm. And that's where we're living our lives at. You know, it's not about one genre in particular. It's about, you know, just letting our love overtake the airwaves, and people start placing us wherever they want to place us, you know, and that's cool. We love that.
Yeah, and you remarked briefly about Aretha Franklin before we turned the tape on, and it's been a heck of a week and a remarkable service and a remarkable time to reflect on her. But her story, Ray Charles' story, is one level that's really cool about it, is it brought a sacred kind of appreciation and awe to everyday life. You know, it said that these are not separate things, that if you know, we can regard young love, old love, trouble, just travel, anything that we live, we can regard it with that sort of deep, you know, sacred kind of approach. What does that make you think of, Tanya? I mean, how does that feed y'all's music?
Well, I'll echo what Michael said when we think about, you know, what the people before us have done in this country, not just in this country, but, you know, abroad, to keep the message of love and hope and faith and unity alive, you know. And for this music, it's an honor to be able to sing this music and to carry on the sound from our forefathers and those who came before us to do it.
Mm-hmm. Not as just singers, but writers too, yeah?
Yes. Yeah. Michael wrote everything on this project. And, you know, even for me, it's helped me. I just start picking up the auto harp, you know, and playing the auto harp and sitting on the porch sometimes and just strumming it and coming up with songs like, you know, Mom Maybelle did, because it takes you back to your roots. And that's the roots of America, you know, is that we did everything with foot stomping and, like Michael said, guitar picking and hand clapping and things like the auto harp.
Creaking floorboards.
So it helped, you know, it's exciting to be able to bring that sound into our music.
I loved it when I heard that auto harp chime in, because it's so unique. There is nothing like it, that brushing metallic sound. But it's built in around a lot of sounds. When you described that you at some point were just a duo, but the record brings a full band sound. As now, do you think War and Treaty is a band and the band carries a full rhythm section? Is that the way it is now, or what?
Well, we're still a duo,
mm-hmm.
but Michael is extremely creative with sound, and I think I'll let him tell a little bit more about that and
production.
Why. Yeah, the production side of it.
yeah. You know, it's funny, you talk about the record, because we enlisted the great producer, Buddy Miller himself,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, Buddy said, well, let me see what you got. And I showed him what I had. And his mind did what I wanted it to do.
Okay.
Which was hear what was missing. You know, and I was willing to go with that. You know, and Buddy was a teacher. You know, he would say, what do you hear, Michael? And I would call out one instrument, and he challenged me on it. He said, are you really hearing that, or are you hearing this? And I'm like, well, I wasn't hearing that, but now I am.
Mm.
And that's the right move, you know. And so when you hear all of that and then you come and see War and Treaty live and you see this band, it's like, you know, wow, they got such a full sound out of just three guys or four guys, you know. And it just feels so good to not deny anything. Don't deny any part of what you hear, but just go with it. You know, so you might hear an auto harp in there, you might hear a Barry sax, you know, and you're definitely going to hear the pedal steel, but you won't hear the pedal steel in a setting that you would thought you would hear it in.
Oh, yeah.
We'll put it in some soul music instead of bluegrass or country, throw it in some soul.
So is it fair to say that you let that record, the sound, the layers form, the full band sound emerge, and then said, well, we'll think about getting that produced on stage, singing it on stage later? Or were you thinking, did you have in mind, we've got to go and we've got to perform this stuff?
I don't record anything I can't hear live.
Okay.
That's been my thing. You know, if I can't perform it live, I won't record it.
What do you play, Michael, when you're on stage?
I play keys.
Yeah.
And I sing, but if I don't hear the people clapping to it or foot stomping to it or weeping to it, it ain't worth doing for me.
Tanya, do you play an instrument when y'all are performing?
Just the tambourine.
Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And yeah, I just do that and enjoy what everything else around me, the sounds around.
And then how many guys do you carry around when you go on tour?
Three. Yeah, and they're all multi-instrumentalists, sometimes four. They play everything. These guys are so amazing and incredible to travel around the country with.
Cool. Mm-hmm. We didn't have time to go down the list of songs, but one that kind of, I think, jumped out and summed it up for me, One and the Same, just seemed to kind of pull together a lot of the themes that y'all are about and that was on the record. Who just talk about the writing of that song? And
it's one of my favorite songs on the album. I remember us just performing this song, I guess, for the last maybe year and a half. We would just go out and sing it, and it just reflects on where we are in the world, you know, with everything that's going on and all the ups and downs and the news and all the negativity. There's a core foundation of all of us that we are all the same. We all want love. We all want to be able to raise our families safely. We all want to live to be a certain age to be able to see, you know, how our lives are going to unfold. And that makes us all one and the same.
I remember where I was when I wrote that song.
Yeah.
It was such a aha moment because I was watching a movie, and the movie was Walk the Line, which was a story of Johnny Cash, of course. Mm-hmm. And it made me go and do some more research because, first off, I am a huge Johnny Cash fan. And I then saw clips where it was Johnny Cash and Mahalia Jackson. Johnny Cash and Ray Charles, and you know, you often will see a black artist sing with a white artist, and I'm like, that is the most beautiful sound ever.
That would have been from the TV show, from the Johnny Cash show, from the Ryman.
Yeah. And I'm like, if we can sing that well together, I just believe we could live that well together as well.
Yeah.
And I was willing to die for that thought. I didn't care who hurt her. And so that's where if you listen to the lyrics, some say it's worth fighting for. As for me, I think it's worth dying for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll hold my end of the bargain, but I'm going to hold it peacefully. You know, and then even in there, we talk about some say it's about black or white. Some say one is wrong while the other is right. They judge a book by the cover that they won't even read. Such a big misunderstanding, you know, and then I had left religion alone. You know, I ain't claiming to be Jesus, but I do believe in miracles. And I am shouting out the good news, but I'm not going to preach your gospel. When it all adds up, we're all just one and the same, you know. And these are the beliefs that were floating around in my body. And when I brought them forward to Tanya, I realized that these are the beliefs that was flowing in Tanya's body. And then I brought her to Karen or Susie or Bob or little Pookie on the corner. And I realized all these different kinds of folks from different strokes of life all feel like this. Wow, we are truly one and the same. And there you have it.
Yeah, thanks for the recitation. I love that. That's a great new way to hear it.
Yeah.
So the song about New Bern. Is that North Carolina? It's the only New Bern
yes,
I know.
Yes, it is North Carolina.
And it's way out on the coast.
Yes,
and
it is.
I haven't been to New Bern explicitly. I've been around further out on the Outer Banks, right around there. But I can imagine what that low, flat land is like. And so that was a grandparents' farm or something?
Yes, my grandparents' farm was there. And they still, my aunts and uncles and cousins, they still have the farm there.
Cool.
And spent every summer with my grandparents. And that was my summer camp.
Mm-hmm.
And it was some incredible memories that were made there. So Michael had an opportunity to go down there, and he wrote about what he saw and what I told him.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's Michael's artistic interpretation
yes.
of your background and your story and the yes. ground and the location.
Yes.
That's cool.
Yes, definitely. And just telling him about my aunt, Sis, and how my grandfather was a grave digger and a farmer, you know, taught all of the boys how to dig graves and all the girls how to farm.
I'd love to ask more and more about that. One other question for you, Michael, about your background, which is such an incredible story, but your being pulled into that remarkable, heavy, and kind of beautiful duty of writing songs about fallen brothers in Iraq.
Yeah.
That is such an extraordinary crash course in the songwriter's art and getting in touch with a subject that's going to affect other people. You know how that it has to be received, right? It's much more important. The stakes are very high.
Yeah.
What are your quick reflections on that and how you brought that songwriter's craft home?
I'll tell you what, it was one of the most stressful times in my life. Not because it was hard, but because you had to deal with your own emotions face forward. I mean, hearing it, you're writing about your own battle buddy, you know, and in the back of your mind, you're thinking, I know I gotta be next, I gotta be next, I gotta be next. And you keep flirting with the idea that it's gonna happen to you. And you're writing, it's gonna happen to me, but then I'm writing, it's gonna happen to me. And then you finally realize, you know what, this is crazy. Look at the opportunity you have to bring healing, to bring some sort of resolution or some, you know, and then you just get filled with honor and you allow, your battle buddies allow you to just sing to them while they're crying, sing to me, Trotter. They're afraid, sing to me, Trotter. The bomb happens and after the bomb is done, sing to me, Trotter. That's all I can remember is troops asking me to sing to them. And it's the greatest feeling in the world. And it helped me and prepared me to write Little New Burn because I was already interpreting other people's stories.
Oh, yeah.
So it really was an honor and a joy. And there's nothing more I can say about that.
Well, yeah. You picked up a bit of the journalism quality of getting enough facts and enough background that you can put them in the story in a real way that they recognize, and then turning it into some poetry, and turning it into the musical, spiritual experience that happens between a listener and a singer.
Yep.
What an amazing process, and I hope you write a book about that one day, because that's a deep story. There's no way to touch on that quickly, you know. And then to wrap up, when did you hear that tale? When did he first, what was it like to, as you got to know Michael, to discover that chapter of his life? That would have been one of the most remarkable things to learn about somebody.
Well, the interesting thing is we had been married for 3 years before I even knew that he served in the military, and he had known the war. And I remember one July, I think it was the 4th of July, and our little one wanted to go see the fireworks, and we heard a loud boom. And Michael, just frantic, you know, from the sound. I didn't know what was going on because I didn't know he had served in the war.
Yeah.
And he shared what had happened to him, that he had gone to war. And then as time kept going on, I just started to experience, you know, his daydreaming. Like, why was he always daydreaming? And when I thought he was daydreaming, he actually wasn't daydreaming. He really physically wasn't, or mentally wasn't there with myself and my son. Mm. His mind was over in the war zone of Iraq. And I rolled up my sleeves from that point on and was like, you know what? We're gonna get through this together and we're gonna heal through this together. And we went through a series of therapy and just loving each other in some very, very hard times.
Mm-hmm.
But when I knew that the storytelling part was something that was could be used as therapy, he started just writing like 7 or 8, 9, 10 songs a day. Even now, he still does that. And that's when I knew that this was a part of who he was. And it opened up, you know, from that moment, once he let me in to, this is what was going on. This is, you know, when you see me daydreaming, I'm writing songs, but I don't want to irritate you by writing 9, 10 songs a day. It was just like, you know, wonderful. It was a beautiful experience, and I love hearing all of his songs.
Yeah.
And hearing how what happened to him and meeting the different soldiers that he's gone to war with over the last, you know, 2 or 3 years. You know, some of them have perished, but just even hearing his stories, and he writes songs about them even now, you know.
Wow, that's profound. I really appreciate you sharing that, and I appreciate the impact it's having on your work, and I just absolutely wish you the very best.
Thank you so much.